This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Elena Stein, who's the head of strategy for Jewish Voice for Peace.
So far, this largely Jewish organization has shut down Grand Central Station, had an amazing demonstration at the Statue of Liberty, and is bringing the message of peace and justice for the Palestinian people all over America.
We're also going to speak with Amina Kwasi, who's been an activist in Palestine solidarity work in Los Angeles.
She will provide us with a background of decades of the persecution of the Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli government.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
In 1948, 750,000 Palestinians were terrorized, murdered, and driven out of their homeland in Palestine, where they'd lived for thousands of years. Many fled to Gaza at the southern end of what is now Israel. Gaza is a tiny strip of land along the Mediterranean and is one of the most densely populated areas in the world. 560 of their villages were destroyed, and the remaining Palestinians were left to live in 22% of historic Palestine. The process of murder, terror, and displacement is going on again. 1,500,000 Palestinians, many of them descendants of the refugees from 1948, have been driven out of northern Gaza. Their homes have been bombed and destroyed. Their hospital, mosques, churches, and schools have been bombed. And already, 11,000 have been killed, almost half of them children. Israel has cut off clean water, medicine, electricity, fuel, and food, and ordered them to get out or be killed. Israeli ground troops are going door to door, mopping up those who have not fled. The genocidal operation has the full support of the American establishment and the mainstream media. Israel is a strategic military ally of the United States and gets support from the military-industrial complex and right-wing, Republican-oriented American Jews. But this time, there's a pushback. Thousands of young American Jews have not been taken in by the propaganda and identify with the new organization Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP. JVP has organized thousands of people in spectacular demonstrations that have shut down Grand Central Station in New York City, blocked entrances to Congress, sat in on the Capitol Rotunda, and massed at the Statue of Liberty. These have been some of the largest acts of civil disobedience since the Iraq War and the largest demonstrations of Jewish people in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for freedom ever. We speak today with Elena Stein. She is the director of strategy for Jewish Voice for Peace. She lives in New York City. Elena Stein, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Elena, when was Jewish Voice for Peace founded? What was the motivation of those who founded it? And what are its general demands with respect to, in Rashid Khalidi's phrase, which is the title of his great book, The 100-Year War Against Palestine?
Jewish Voice for Peace was founded 25 years ago, and today we are the largest progressive anti-Zionist Jewish organization in the world. We're organizing a grassroots, multiracial, multigenerational movement of U.S. Jews into solidarity with the Palestinian freedom struggle. This is rooted in us envisioning a world where all people, from the U.S. to Palestine, live in freedom, justice, equality, and dignity, and we really do mean all people. Like generations of Jewish leftists before us, we fight for the liberation of all people. We believe that through organizing, we can and will dismantle the institutions and the structures that sustain injustice, and that we can grow something different in its place, something new, something joyful, something beautiful, something life-sustaining. And that is what we are committed to and doing today. I'm alive because the day that my grandmother's entire family was massacred in the Holocaust in a shtetl in Lithuania, she just happened to be absent. So I've agonized for years over the question, what were her neighbors thinking? Why did they just stand by? So today, it is with all of my Jewish ancestors at my back, the one who survived and all those who didn't, that we are morally compelled to refuse to be neighbors who just stand by. And right now, what that means is that we have to create an international outcry sufficient to change the political calculus of Biden in Congress in order to stop the bombing, in order for them to demand a ceasefire, right? Because the U.S. government, we know, isn't just standing by. The U.S. government is funding and fueling and enabling these mass atrocities. 80% of the bombs that the Israeli government is using right now in this genocidal onslaught in Gaza are coming from the United States. Right now, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of children buried beneath the rubble. They're dying in the cold beneath the rubble, and the bulldozers that might have otherwise been used to pull people out of that rubble have no fuel and cannot operate because the Israeli government refuses to let it in, just as it refuses to let in medicine and food, right? So even not in a moment of this level of crisis, Palestinians are living under occupation, apartheid, the siege of Gaza. This is daily brutality, daily cruelty, right? One day you can be living in your home in the West Bank, and the next settlers can have taken over it and claimed your home as theirs. So this is what I mean when I say we refuse to be neighbors who just stand by. It is our moral obligation as Americans, whose government is funding and fueling and arming these atrocities, while protecting the Israeli government from all levels of international accountability, to do everything we can to stop this. And Jewish Voice for Peace offers a political home as a place to do that work. It offers thriving, multi-generational, multiracial political community rooted in values of justice and freedom and dignity for all, rooted in the culture of care and trust, rooted in Judaism beyond Zionism, you know, rooted really in life and in love. And I'm incredibly humbled and honored to get to call it my political home to do this work that, frankly, I feel I'm on the planet for.
Elena Stein, in the wake of the almost unimaginable plight of the Palestinian people, the now worldwide recognition of the devastating humanitarian crisis unfolding in Gaza, Jewish Voice for Peace has organized, with your pivotal participation, several spectacular protest actions of late. These included JVP's taking over Grand Central Station in New York City, the 500 people protesting at the Statue of Liberty, the sitting in the halls of Congress. What were your principal demands at these demonstrations, and what has been the impact on the situation?
You know, the wonderful late Jewish organizer and writer Grace Paley said, the only recognizable feature of hope is action. These are words that have been ringing in my ears these last 5 weeks. The only recognizable feature of hope is action. So here is what hope in action has been looking like right now. We are organizing right now the largest demonstrations of Jewish people in solidarity with Palestinian freedom in history. With only 3 days notice, we put out a call saying, come to D.C. at noon on a Wednesday. It's a terrible time for a demonstration. And we had no idea how many people would come. Well, 5,000 people figured out how to get out of work, find childcare, and train or bus or even fly to D.C. for what became the largest Jewish-led demonstration in solidarity with Palestinian freedom in history. And that day, 500 people from those 5,000 got arrested occupying a key Capitol building, doing a sit-in that was calling out for the demand of a ceasefire, making headlines around the world. Just 1 week later, thousands then filled Grand Central Terminal, with many thousands more outside, with rabbis and elders and elected officials leading us in a new song called Ceasefire Now, shutting down the terminal in the largest action of mass civil disobedience in New York since the beginning of the Iraq War. Now, this day that we did this action at Grand Central, it was the first day the Israeli government shut Gaza off from electricity. And how did the world respond? How did we respond? Well, through that demonstration, hashtag Ceasefire Now, rose in rows in Twitter trends until by the end of the night, it was number one, with the World Series lagging behind. And then a week later, on a Monday, 550 people figured out how to get out of work and risked possibly getting federal charges in order to lead the largest civil disobedience action ever at the Statue of Liberty, organized in secret. It made the New York Times front page for the third week in a row, and the images went around the world. And this momentum isn't stopping. Just a couple of days ago, 700 people with Jewish Voice for Peace, and if not now, shut down the federal building and the largest civil disobedience in the Bay since the Iraq War, while Chicago organized the largest Jewish demonstration in solidarity with Palestinian freedom in the Midwest ever. Right? And none of this is to even mention dozens of other lockdowns and sit-ins and takeovers of federal buildings, shutting down highways by Jewish people right now demanding a ceasefire. So you asked about impact. These are some of the most significant anti-war protests in nearly two decades. They are creating an awareness of U.S. complicity. They are exposing that Israel does not speak for all Jews. And they're exposing that the U.S. government's interest in supporting the Israeli military is not about Jewish safety. It's about the U.S.'s own interests. Our hope is that these actions create a path for Jewish people who, like me, were sort of sold an investment in Zionism as the false answer to the real question of Jewish safety, and to instead join a path that's about true Jewish values, you know, Betzalem Elohim, every life is precious, as well as basic human values. And they garner these actions, they garner mainstream media coverage with an unimpeachable moral message. And that's that we need a ceasefire now for the preservation of the lives of 2.3 million Palestinians and 240 Israeli hostages. And thus, they create the bottom-up pressure to allow increasing numbers of members of Congress to act on their conscience and demand a ceasefire.
Elena, why do you believe that Israel, well, for decades now, has gotten so much military, diplomatic, and political support from the U.S.? The United States has provided Israel with tens of billions of dollars in military aid. Biden now wants to send, you know, billions more of such aid. What explains this lockstep relationship between the U.S. and Israel? Does it flow from, as you mentioned, you think it doesn't. You say it doesn't really flow from a genuine desire on the part of the United States to protect Jewish people after the Holocaust. So then what do you think it is about? Or what are the geopolitical reasons, I guess, that behind the U.S.'s unfailing support for Israel?
I'm so appreciative of this question. I once thought, and I think so many still do, that the U.S. backed Israel because it wanted safety for Jewish people. I value safety for Jewish people. I value safety for my family, for my loved ones. Isn't that why the U.S. gives more funding to Israel than any other place in the world in history? Well, it turns out that quote-unquote Jewish safety is just a moral cover for the United States. The U.S. is operating out of its own imperial interests. So I think for me, and I suspect for many people, it can be hard to understand why there is such ironclad backing. How is it that we can be watching these images of children being massacred and hear from our political leaders, who some of whom profess decent values in other respects, that they won't back down? What is that about? Well, here is the first fact that I learned that changed my understanding of why the U.S. is doing this. The U.S. sends more money to Israel than anywhere else in history. Why? It's not aid in the traditional sense. It's not for health care or housing for poor Israelis. All of the money that the United States sends to Israel has to be used on the Israeli military. And not only that, but the majority of that money used on the Israeli military has to be spent back in the United States on U.S. defense contractors. So the U.S. is, in effect, propping up its own war economy. Stock prices of weapons manufacturers right now are skyrocketing. So that is a key part of the answer here. A second key part is that the U.S. wants an outpost in the Middle East. And another really important element here that I didn't know for so long is Christian Zionism. Right? The Christian right supports Israel. not because they love Jews. They see the establishment of the modern state of Israel as fulfillment of prophecies that they believe to be necessary to the second coming of Jesus. So in this understanding, the vision is that a tiny minority of living Jews will, in the end times, convert to Christianity, and the rest will be damned to hell. To be clear, this is a profoundly anti-Semitic belief system, and it's entirely pro-Israel. There are more Christian Zionists in the United States than there are Jewish people in the United States total. Right? Yesterday, at the major pro-Israel rally in Washington, D.C., who was invited to speak but the most prominent Christian Zionist in America, Pastor John Hagee, who claimed that God sent Hitler to create Israel. He also, by the way, blamed Hurricane Katrina on gay people. Okay, this guy is a raging anti-Semite, and he is the leader of the largest Christian Zionist organization in the country, Christians United for Israel, or CUFI. So, to be clear, the U.S.'s unabashed and unprecedented funding and backing and protection of the Israeli government at all costs and military is not because it loves Jews. It doesn't care about us. It cares about its own economy and about having an outpost in the Middle East. And this is why it's incumbent upon all Americans to rise up against this and demand accountability from the U.S. government. We need a resurgence of the anti-war movement like never before, and it truly is a responsibility not just of Palestinians to be leading this struggle, not just on Jews to be pulling back this moral cover, but every single person in the United States. It is a responsibility of all of us.
Well said, Elena. We're speaking with Elena Stein from Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're here on Law and Disorder Radio. Elena, there are 7.3 million Israelis and 7.3 Palestinians all living in the same place. Israel has refused to allow the Palestinians their own country. Israel is attempting now to change the population balance by driving over 1 million Palestinians into Egypt. How do you appreciate that fact, and what is the JVP response?
We need a ceasefire immediately for the preservation of the lives of all 2.3 million Palestinians living in Gaza and all 240 Israeli hostages. The facts are brutal. Over 11,000 Palestinians have been killed in this genocidal onslaught on top of 1,200 Israelis. At least 4,500 are children. And we know that these numbers are an undercount, right? The Israeli military is bombing and invading hospitals. They are murdering doctors. NICU babies have been unplugged and are lying in wait for their death. There are countless children beneath the rubble right now. Who will die there? And it's not just these numbers that I've named. It's 2.3 million people who are at risk of starvation because the Israeli government will not allow in food or fuel or medicine. So our number one priority right now is doing whatever we can to save lives. And that means winning a ceasefire. That is what people in Gaza are pleading for, and it has to be our top priority. Now, number two, Israel is hell-bent on destroying Palestinian life. It has been for 75 years. It has shown that whenever it has a chance, it will visit untold horrors. Against this reality, it is the role of us, United States, to build a mass movement to end U.S. support for the Israeli state's mass atrocities. So, while it is our job right now to demand a ceasefire, to win a ceasefire, to make these bombs stop, we also have to do that in a way such that once we win that ceasefire, we've built a movement with more people, with more commitment, with more strategies for the long haul, until full Palestinian freedom.
Elena, one of the things that interests me, and I'd be very anxious to get your thoughts on, is what has happened with respect to the support that Israel has, well, for as long as I can think of it now, enjoyed from American Jews. But it's changing some, isn't it? And it wasn't long ago that the overwhelming majority of Jews in America were more or less fully and rather unquestionably in most cases, supportive of Israel. But in recent times, more and more Jews in America, and especially younger Jews, it seems, have come to be highly critical of Israel and much more supportive of the Palestinian cause. So why do you think this rather dramatic change in the attitudes of American Jews has taken place? And will not this current round in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict only further harden their anti-Israeli views?
Jewish people are joining this beautiful struggle for freedom in droves right now. But I want to clarify that we are not anti-Israeli. We are certainly anti-Israeli government. But working towards the end of Israeli apartheid is actually the only choice for everyone, right? We are being sold a myth that there's a zero-sum game here, that it's either Palestinian lives or it's Israeli lives. We have to break through this. Ending Israeli apartheid and occupation, of course, is the only way forward for Palestinians who are literally dying under its brutality. But it's also the only choice for Israelis who will not be kept safe through a government rooted in oppression, through a state rooted in oppression. It won't work. That is a false answer to the real question of Jewish safety. So when we are out there fighting for Palestinian freedom, we are fighting for everyone, and that means Israeli life. We grieve Israeli life, and we treasure every life as precious. And it's only by getting to the root of this structure that everyone is going to be able to live in safety and freedom. Jewish people are joining the movement for Palestinian freedom in droves right now because they understand this, because we are human and we understand our moral obligations to each other, and also because we believe in Jewish futures rooted in justice. So what I would say is, you know, to every person who has been in utter agony this past month, you are not alone. If you know that this isn't the path, having our government supporting massacre is not the path, you are part of something much bigger. You are part of a movement. Now, you wouldn't know it just by watching mainstream news, which is incredibly one-sided and makes it hard to see, but you are not alone. I go back to that quote from Grace Paley, the only recognizable feature of hope is action. Join an organization, join this movement, take action from home or in the streets. This agony we are all carrying has the potential to be transformed into collective power. It is actually, in this moment, it is being transformed into collective power. There is nothing more beautiful than being in an action surrounded by multiple generations, singing movement songs together, and seeing that you are winning headlines that is actually moving the needle. People keep saying, by participating in this action, it was transformative for me. I'm now in this movement for the long haul. This is the most important action of my life. This is a place where people say, my relationships are forged. I was able to build across difference. So if you feel isolated or in this agony, this is the answer. Join us in action.
You know, Elena, on November 14th, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of Palestinians against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Defense Secretary Austin. They are being sued for their complicity in the unfolding genocide taking place. I know you are very close to the ex-president of CCR, Michael Ratner, who was, by the way, also the founder of this radio show. It strikes me this is something he certainly would have been approved of, this lawsuit. But what are your own thoughts on the lawsuit?
Yes, Michael Ratner, a former co-host of this show and the incredible international human rights attorney, was my beloved father-in-law, and he would be so profoundly proud right now of this lawsuit. As you shared, Palestinians from Gaza and the United States filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court suing President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin to stop U.S. support for Israel's unfolding genocide against them and against their families and the Palestinian people. Together with the attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights, the plaintiffs are asking the court to declare that the U.S. is aiding and abetting an unfolding genocide. And they're seeking an immediate end to U.S. military and diplomatic support to Israel. right? Because numerous Israeli government leaders have expressed clear genocidal intentions. And they are making unbelievably dehumanizing characterizations of Palestinians, like, quote, human animals. And we know at the same time, Israeli military has bombed civilian areas and infrastructure and used chemical weapons and deprived Palestinians of everything necessary for human life, like water and fuel and food and electricity and medicine. So this is, I think, a historic lawsuit. I am so proud and grateful to the lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights for filing this. Michael Ratner would be so proud. And this lawsuit is now in the hands of the people. It is on us to help make use of it. So much of what we are facing right now is people denying the genocidal nature of what we are seeing. And so I would encourage people to look up this suit and to use its incredible documentation to see exactly what is happening, to pull back the curtain on it, and to not allow ourselves to be gaslit in this moment by what is unfolding, and to use this lawsuit to ignite a level of urgency and moral clarity that is so desperately needed right now.
Elena Stein from Jewish Voice for Peace. Unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time here, but before we have to say goodbye to you, let me ask you one last question. How can people follow the work of JVP?
Follow us on social media, Jewish Voice for Peace. Also, go to jvp.org/ceasefire to sign a petition calling on Biden to demand a ceasefire. And from there, there are so many ways to plug in. You can sign up for the JVP Wire for excellent analysis in your inbox once a week. Until there is a ceasefire, we will have daily power half hours Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. East to take the most useful actions from your home. And also, join JVP as an official member. You know, Israel purports to speak in the name of all Jews, and the way that we counter that is by standing up and being counted. You know, alone, each of us is only so powerful, but when we get organized, when we join organization and can get information with each other, we have collective power, and we are building it right now with a determination like never before. Join us.
Elena Stein, Jim and I would like to thank you from the bottom of our heart for the good work that you're doing, good work that JVP is doing, every success. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Israel's war in Gaza, which has already created a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions, now threatens to spread even more death and destruction as Israel's military force, the IDF, has now occupied the last hospital in Gaza still barely functioning as it attempts to, you know, operate without electricity or medical supplies. And this at a time when Israel's IDF forces also claim to control all of northern Gaza and Gaza City. Notably, the Israeli forces, though occupying the hospital, despite their earlier claims to the contrary, have failed to produce any real proof that the hospital was being used by the forces of Hamas for military purposes. Of course, for some weeks now, many world leaders and United Nations officials have declared that what Israel is doing in Gaza, well, it amounts to genocide. And so far, even efforts at achieving any meaningful pause in the fighting, let alone a real ceasefire, remain beyond reach, still being opposed by Israel and by the Biden administration. Meanwhile, no one is prepared to predict an end to the slaughter in Gaza, as the civilian death toll continues to grow and as Gaza's infrastructure continues to disappear. And so the protests over the war, the accusations of war crimes and crimes against humanity on the part of Israel continue to grow as well. Indeed, in the last week, there have been huge anti-Israeli protests here and all around the world, including a massive one organized by the Orthodox Jewish community in the United States. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is coming under more and more attacks from members of its own administration. Already, more than 400 high-level and mid-level government officials in the Biden administration have sent Biden letters protesting his refusal to ask Israel to declare a ceasefire, and many of them have resigned in protest. Well, to help us understand where matters stand and what they might mean, we're fortunate to have as our guest today, attorney Amina Kwasi. Ms. Kwasi is the co-executive director of the Peace and Justice Law Center in Los Angeles. She formerly served as the deputy executive director and attorney for the Greater Los Angeles Area Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, which is the largest American Muslim civil rights and advocacy group. And Ms. Kwasi is, I'm proud to say, also a former executive director of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Amina Kwasi, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks, Jim and Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Amina, I think maybe before we really get deeply into this, let me ask you this question. I suspect that most Americans don't have a very clear picture of what life was like in Palestine before this latest round in the 75 years of occupation and war. And it's, I think, important to put that into context, certainly. So give our audience a sense of what was going on there, the arrest, the displacements, the arrest of children, throwing stones, all of that. Talk to us a bit about that so that people have a clearer idea of what life looked like there when October 7th came along.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'd like to go even a little bit further back from that because I think it's important for people to understand that the Palestinians had a flourishing, vibrant society before the occupation began. It was a multi-faith, burgeoning society developing before the occupation officially began and the State of Israel was established in 1948. But years before that, when colonization first began, people started being displaced. People started losing their rights. In 1948, with the official establishment of the State of Israel, it is what the Palestinians and their allies across the world called the Nakba, the catastrophe, where 750,000 Palestinians were forced from their homes. Villages were massacred, and people were pushed into neighboring countries, into a diaspora, or into what we know now as Gaza and as the West Bank. And during that time, for Palestinians both now living in what is recognized as Israel and for those living in the occupied Palestinian territories, people suffer from arbitrary and mass arrests, fake trials and tribunals in front of the IDF, a disproportionate use of force for nothing, for throwing stones at tanks, the displacement of people continuously, whether it be in the ceded territories within occupied Palestine, like in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, and also the lack of food, water, humanitarian aid. So, you know, I just really quickly, Jim, I turned 18 in 2000. I'm officially a millennial. Throughout my adult life for the last 23 years, all I have known is one by one this sort of persistent daily life for the Palestinians, and then what we have known as the flare-up. So, in, for example,
in 2000, Ariel Sharon went into the El Quds complex, a massacre back in the 80s, and he goes into this religious place surrounded by soldiers. So that's what started the Intifada at that time. In 2008, there was Operation Cast Lead into the Gaza territory, which killed thousands. In 2010, if you remember, there was the international flotilla of six boats filled with humanitarian aid and construction material trying to break the Israeli and Egyptian blockade to get supplies to Gaza. And multiple people were killed in the flotilla, and many more people were injured. In 2021, there was the Israeli annexation of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And that East Jerusalem is part of Palestine. And the Israeli Supreme Court said that permitted that to happen. And then in 2023, earlier this year, when we're all celebrating and have our increased worship services during our holy month of Ramadan, I'm Muslim, we had the IDF was going into, again, Masjid al-Aqsa, one of the three of our holy most places, forcing worshippers out from the Al-Quds complex. And then you have all of what I've been telling you about. So this has been ongoing, persistent, consistent, and this is really a modern-day colonialism. It is an apartheid state. Some people have been calling this the ongoing catastrophe, the ongoing Nakba. And when we look at what's going on currently, we see that it is absolutely the genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza. That's all it is. It is part of the plan to push the Palestinians off of their land. That's been the plan all along.
Amina, this is Michael Smith. We know now, as the result of recent public opinion polls, one in fact taken only the day before the conflict began, that the overwhelming number of Palestinian people oppose Hamas's rule in Gaza. As someone who cares deeply about human rights, justice, and the rule of law, were you also disapproving and disheartened by the alleged brutal, cruel, and illegal actions by Hamas at the start of this round in this decades-old war between Israel and the Palestinian people, or I should say more accurately, war on the Palestinian people?
You know, I would add, not just as a person who cares about human rights, justice, the rule of law, but like just as a human, as a mother, as, you know, when I hear stories about children being kidnapped, children being killed, children buried under rubble, being separated from their parents, my heart, like I feel pain in my heart for that to happen to anyone. It doesn't matter to me, you know, if what is their creed. It doesn't matter to me what their nationality is. And I think that's really important for us to never lose our humanity for anyone when we're looking at this situation. Because if we lose our humanity, then there's no hope for any of this, the occupation or the genocide, to ever end. What I really want to point out is that when we talk about Hamas and when we talk about October 7th, for the general public to understand, as I stated in the first, this didn't start on October 7th. You know, the ongoing occupation, the apartheid, the genocide has been going on for many, many years. Hamas is a small player in all of this. Hamas does not exist in East Jerusalem. Hamas does not exist in the West Bank. This is not about Hamas. It is also not about Israel's right to self-defense. Like, people keep saying Israel has the right to self-defense. Well, also under Article 51 of the UN Charter, no state, no country has the right to defend themselves against a territory that is under their belligerent occupation. It is not a recognized international right to use defense against the people you are occupying. Even if you look at, like, a U.S. basic criminal law on self-defense as a theory, the part claiming the defense of self-defense cannot be at fault. If they are at fault, if they create the conditions that led to the need of the use of force, it is an imperfect claim of self-defense. So I just don't understand, you know, why people and the American public keeps citing this, because we know it's not accurate. It's not valid under U.S. law. It's not valid under international law. I think what happens is when we talk about this need for self-defense, we say, oh, you know, there's all this collateral damage. All these people are dying. But really, we're also detracting from the fact that that is their exact purpose and intent, is for the Palestinians to die and to be pushed out. That has been, they've been choking the Palestinians for decades, and this is part of the project. It's not self-defense at all, and it's not about Hamas.
It's also important, I think, to note that in recent days, there's been some serious questions raised by some serious investigative journalists as to whether or not we're getting the true story about that initial attack by Hamas. There's some evidence emerging that it may not have been the kind of cruel and mindless outreach of destruction and brutality that was first reported. We'll wait and see. But at any rate, your point about the right to self-defense is a good one, and that it exists only for the one country who's being illegally occupied. A recent poll, is always, I think, has something to do with what people have known before or not. We'll find out. But a recent poll shows 66% now of the American people watching this go on for this last month have come to support a call for a ceasefire in the war, 66%, which both Israel and Biden administration have steadfastly refused to accept. When this round, however, of war first started, in the first week of the war, the YouGov poll showed overwhelming support for Israel's side in the war. But as the weeks of war have gone on, a far, far greater number of American people have now found themselves supporting the Palestinian side than they did at the beginning. And this evidence around the ceasefire, I think, is part of that. What do you think explains this initial disparity of sympathies in the United States between the American people and the rest of the world who have largely supported the Palestinian side? Is it the unawareness of what you've just been describing previously, or what?
You know, I'd love to answer that, but first, if I could just give voice to my absolute frustration with so much of the American public, because so many of us on October 8th, we saw what was happening, we knew what was coming, and when we saw rallies happening, that was because we knew how Israel was responding, because, like I said, this has been going on for decades. And it's frustrating to me that how many people have to die, how many children need to be buried under rubble before people say, oh yeah, it seems a little disproportionate, it seems a little bit excessive. And still people, our elected officials, still can't seem to come to that conclusion. And you know, even 80% of Democrats, I should say, that was a statistic I've read, are now in support of a ceasefire. And it's one, going back to that false narrative about the right to self-defense, like this started on October 7th and Israel has this right to self-defense. It's a false narrative that's being pushed for many, many years now. And it's also because of a lack of coverage and knowledge about the apartheid, the ongoing Nakba that has been going on for decades. Like these large incidents that have happened throughout the years, we do get a story, we get to, and then, you know, the media wave dives down. But in terms of the ongoing suffering of the Palestinian people, that is not something that is being covered in the media. It's not being something that's been discussed. Even when we try to include Palestinian narratives in ethnic studies, there is a concerted project by groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Brandeis Center to actually take out the Palestinian narrative from school programs because they don't want people to know what's been going on. So people hear, oh my God, there was this Hamas and there's this raid October 7th and, you know, people were being beheaded and people were being raped. And, you know, so with the lack of context, the lack of narrative, and I think, frankly, it comes down also to racism. Racism is such an endemic disease in this country where, you know, we, the United States, still incarcerate more of our population than any other country. And most of those people are Black Americans. You know, that is why the liberation for Blacks and other people of color, but especially the Black community in the United States, is directly tied to Palestinian liberation. Because until we address racism here in the United States, you know, we will enable these sort of racist, nationalistic governments and colonialist powers to continue their genocidal practices around the world.
Amina, this is Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner and co-host, Jim Lafferty. And it's good to speak with you, Amina. I wanted to ask you this. Supporters of Palestine have claimed for years now that the fact that the United States has annually given billions of dollars of military aid to Israel and given Israel strong political and diplomatic support as well is evidence that America is also guilty of Israelis' war crimes in Palestine and the dire humanitarian crisis that has already come about as a consequence of Israel's attack on the people in Gaza. In fact, the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights has just this week filed a lawsuit against Biden and others claiming that they are complicit in and facilitating Israel's genocidal crimes. Do you agree?
I absolutely wholeheartedly agree that this genocide and the apartheid regime of Israel would not exist and be able to perpetrate the crimes to the extent it is doing if it were not for U.S. funding of it with our tax dollars. You know, there's been $130 billion to fund Israel since 1948, $130 billion. I think that accounts for like 15% or something of our entire like foreign aid ever. $3.8 billion goes to Israel directly every single year. And it was only surpassed by quote-unquote aid, because as Afghani people will tell you, there nothing was aided in Afghanistan the last 20 years, but quote-unquote aid to Afghanistan per year, but still the numbers that have been going to Israel is disproportionate. And even if you look at the war in Ukraine, so last year in 2022, the U.S. Congress, you know, sent about $12 billion in aid to Ukraine against, you know, fighting against this massive global superpower. This year, the House of Representatives, I should say, voted to send $14 billion to the state of Israel in its quote-unquote war against Hamas. You just, like, see the disproportionality even in the numbers. And again, I think another way that the U.S. has directly enabled and cleared the way for the Israeli crimes against the Palestinians is by its position as a world power and its position in the UN and how time and time and time again it has used its vote and its veto power in the UN Security Council to veto resolutions against Israel and sanctions against Israel. It is deliberately silencing the global voices around the world calling for an end to this. The U.S. is playing a very proactive role. I mean, and again, you go back and look at some of these numbers, and you know, to know that there are now about 6,000 political Palestinian prisoners in Israel, and some would call those hostages. Many call those hostages. I call them hostages held by the state of Israel. Right? 6,000 people who are currently being held prisoner by this, and that was before October 7th. You know, these numbers, I don't know if these numbers include the latest people who have been held who were traveling from Gaza to get to work with the work permits in Israel. I don't know if that includes those people, but 6,000 people have been held as hostages by the state of Israel. You know, this goes back to the point of why people think that it's anti-Semitic to pinpoint the crime, what Israel is doing. One, what Israel is doing with its modern weaponry and modern warfare, it is different than what we see in the rest of the world. But secondly, it's different because of the way the United States plays such a direct role in this genocide.
Yeah, and that brings me to my next question, Amina. Sadly, but I suspect not surprisingly, this latest round of the war has found and has produced, really, an increase in both anti-Semitic speech and actions and anti-Muslim Islamic speech and actions as well. In the case of the uptick in anti-Semitism, I want your thought on how much of these attacks are, in your opinion, frankly, justified. How much of what is being called out in the protests, especially at our college campuses and elsewhere, as being anti-Semitic demands, anti-Semitic slogans, really is that, as opposed to criticism, justifiable criticism of Israel? I'm thinking of, you know, the claim that Israel is Zionist and that's part of the problem, and they have an apartheid regime. The chant from the river to the sea can be only interpreted as for the destruction of Israel. just the harsh criticism of Israel in general, calling it an apartheid, saying that it's perpetuating genocide now and has for years. Is that really anti-Semitic speech? What would you say to people who claim it is?
Absolutely not. It's not anti-Semitic speech, and actually it's a disservice to, extreme disservice to anti-Jewish hate. It has confused so many people that people are failing to recognize what is truly anti-Semitic, what is truly hateful towards the Jewish people, which we do need to call out and do want to condemn. And let me just kind of preface this first by saying, again, I'm a practicing observant Muslim woman. You know, I follow, our holy book is the Quran. If I was to be hateful towards the Jewish people in any of this, I would actually be a bad Muslim, because the Jewish people, the Jewish faith, is they're an honored people in our faith tradition. They are considered to be Ahlul Kitab, which is people of the book. It is said that they have access to the heavens if, you know, you believe in God and do good deeds, the people of the book. And honestly, ask any hungry kid out there who only eats halal, you know, can't find food, and he comes across a kosher hot dog, like, he celebrates. We are so happy to be able to share community and faith traditions with our Jewish brothers and sisters. So I would be a bad Muslim if I was to be hateful towards our Jewish brothers and sisters. Being anti-Zionist, criticizing the state of Israel, is not being anti-Semitic. It is actually helping to point out what true anti-Semitic speech is, and it's actually trying to honor what we understand the beauty of the Jewish faith as well. You know, and so things like, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, that is a call for Palestinian, like I said, Palestinian are people in all parts of the land, from the Jordan River to the sea, have been oppressed. It is a call for all of the people there to be liberated. You know, when we talk about, you know, Israel being a genocidal state, because it has this genocidal project. It is deliberately performing these genocidal acts, whereas even Human Rights Watch and other international groups have called out Israel for its crimes of apartheid policies. This is not hyperbole. It's not anti-Semitism. It's trying to bring light on a narrative that has been deliberately quashed for decades. So, you know, it's very, very important to distinguish between the two, and honestly, to not tone police. You can't go, we know so many Palestinians who are losing and have lost dozens and dozens of relatives, in addition to their homes, in addition to their heritage, and to tell them that, please, you know, we don't want you to march, we don't want you to lose this, just go to a vigil and hold a candle. You know, we can't tone police because of the intensity of these crimes. It's such a fundamental trait of our First Amendment rights, not only what you say but how you say it. You know, that is, it is the right of the people, and I really say that it is the best way to get the message across to people at this point.
Amina Kwasi, if Hamas is destroyed, and there's some question about whether one could ever really destroy a movement like that, but let's assume that it was, as a practical matter, destroyed or left powerless, does that mean that the Palestinian people would somehow give up their desire and to fight for their freedom, for their long-denied freedom and sovereignty? Or do you think, in fact, that the war will really never truly end until there is a solution whereby the Palestinian people do have sovereign statehood?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the resistance will continue as long as the Palestinian people are not free. And it should continue, because resistance is justified when a people are occupied. And really, you know, my fear is that if we do get a ceasefire, and there is talk there might be a five-day ceasefire or, you know, halt for humanitarian aid, is that people don't forget, that we don't go back to being a complacent society where, like, okay, you know, no more babies are being buried today. You know, the NICU babies, you know, they might survive for another couple days. So we have to continue our call for Palestinian liberation. And really, that is the only way, that is the only path towards safety, for Palestinian liberation, for Palestinian self-determination, for the right of the return, for some process of atonement and righting the current wrongs, but also the wrongs of the past, there has to be this process, and that is the only way for our whole world to see peace in the region.
And how might people who are listening find out more about what you've been talking about today on our show?
Yes, there's a great group called the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. It's www.uscpr.org. And if people are facing life repercussions in their schools or their workplaces for their Palestinian speech, they can go to Palestine Legal. That's a great organization, and they will be able to tap into a network of attorneys who will be able to help them.
Lamina Kwasi, thank you for that, and thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts with us here on Law and Disorder. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Amina.
Thank you both.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.